branches. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this week,
EOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ, Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW, Warren. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, I'll resume reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education and begin a new chapter that chronicles how economic elites deliberately de-intellectualized America in order to create a tractable labor force for the industrial revolution that coal was to fuel. This is not speculation or imagination. You'll hear evidence from the documentary record that the literate and independent-minded population of mostly family farmers was considered a threat to the establishment of a new social order, one which would put the control of the necessities of life in the hands of a relative few captains of industry and their legions of managers. The children of America were to be deliberately schooled to serve this new system devoted to industrial production. In the last chapter, Gatto wrote about Prussia, the first and foremost example of the modern totalitarian garrison state, and how its population was managed and formed to the needs of the rulers of the state through its tripartite school system. We heard how this school system was deliberately imported into America through the efforts of certain reformers backed by industrialists. The social philosopher John Dewey defined politics as the shadow cast by big business over society. It's more like a total eclipse. The creation, expansion, management, and protection of wealth is, as they say, 9/10 of the law. Our political institutions are dominated by a seemingly perpetual contest between those called liberal and those called conservative, and now neoconservative and neoliberal. These labels actually refer to economic policies, the manner in which the state is used to promote wealth accumulation and distribution under capitalism. The actual content of the policies to which the designations liberal and conservative are applied have changed over time. Some understanding of the history of this provides context to Gatto's writing, which is building the case that students are not the intended beneficiaries of the educational system. So we'll begin the program with a talk by Mel Lehman on the history of liberalism and conservatism. Mel Lehman is a retired professor of economics from SUNY Binghamton. He's the author of the classic textbook, The Political Economy of Racism.
The terms conservative, liberal, democracy can be interpreted in various ways. We all know that. Our leader explains the U.S. as the world's greatest democracy. We obviously recognize that there's a lot of footnotes that are needed to explain what he means. Well, I think that by focusing on the concepts of conservatism and the history of conservatism and liberalism, we'll get some idea of where he's coming from. And remember that Bush is not off, really off the mainstream. He represents a mode of thinking that we have to take seriously, at our peril, in fact, if we do not. In fact, I remember for years and years telling my fellow friends on the left that we were making a great mistake paying no attention to the right. All our efforts were directed toward destroying liberalism. You know, that's what prevented a left-wing movement. Well, what we should have been focusing on, well, what were the forces that were moving both liberals and conservatives to the right? And what did that mean in terms of the American political struggle? And what does democracy mean within the context of capitalism? And is it sufficient? Should everybody be in favor of democracy? And what's the connection of democracy and capitalism? Or democracy and socialism, although I had that in the back of my mind for next time. In any case, I thought it would be useful to start with a brief historical picture of where the terms came from. You've all heard of Adam Smith, the first great writer of political economy in the 1770s. The reason that it's a useful watershed is that in the context of his time, Smith was a liberal, a cautious liberal, but a liberal. Now, what do we mean by that? In order to understand the meaning of liberal, we have to see what existed. And what existed was what is referred to as the mercantilist era. Mercantilism was the system that followed the breakup of feudalism at different periods in different countries. But since England was the head country at that time, let's say in the 1400s. And it was followed by this era called mercantilism. And mercantilism was a kind of state capitalism. That is, private property was accepted, but it was ruled by economic statesmen whose great goal was the development of the nation state. They also had a fetish for acquiring gold, but leave that on the side. And in pursuit of the development of the nation state, they followed a series of policies that were anything but what we connect with conservatism. They favored protective tariffs. They favored control over wages and prices. They gave monopoly privileges to certain merchants. And in fact, American history is connected with that, because remember when we dumped the tea in the Charles River? That was a British company, a monopoly vested company. The drive to get colonies was connected with this. So this was very much of what you might almost call a planned capitalism. The people that ran that system ought to be seen as conservatives. That is, they wanted to preserve and regulate a system in which they were the privileged elite. So Smith came on the scene in the 1760s and 70s, and he had a social point of view. He was saying that this system of mercantilism was not only run for the benefit of a small group of people, but in addition to that, it was socially inefficient. That is, it was putting the stress on trade instead of more basic things for developing the economy, like agriculture and manufacturing. And profits were at a monopolistic level in trade, which pulled in a lot of capital, including some illegal ventures. You know, whenever there's a good deal of money to be made, if people don't have the legal rights, they will get around it illegally. So Smith developed a notion using the French phrase laissez-faire, which literally means hands-off, letting people do what they want to do. And what he was saying is, we need the free market rather than this protected market. If you grab for what you want and I grab for what I want and we're compelled to compete with each other, the greatest number of people in the public will benefit. Why? because prices will be forced down to a natural level. And so you will then allocate capital in a way that would further the wealth of nations. And an ancillary benefit would be that if you had a high rate of growth due to using your capital more efficiently, it would soften the class struggle because everybody would gain. The size of the gross national product would go from this to that. And so even if the share of capital and labor were the same, both would gain in the long run. And so what Smith then was, for that period, a classic liberal in the sense that he was concerned with the benefits of the people, all the people, and not merely benefiting a small group of people. So in other words, conservatism represented maintaining the status quo in which there was a considerable polarized society in which a small number of people benefited. And by the way, in that old system, England was even involved in the slave trade. So Smith represented a moralistic as well as an economistic approach. The free trade was the vehicle for wealth and for reform. And this was followed by subsequent writers. You may have heard of Ricardo, who struggled with a man named Malthus, a conservative, who in fact developed a population doctrine that said that if you want to explain why I'm wealthy and you're poor, it's because you make bad decisions. Instead of getting educated and developing good work habits, you have more children. And so the plight of the poor was attributed to bad choice-making rather than the system, which is what you would expect from a conservative. In fact, it has overtones of today. Scratch a conservative today, and I think they would explain why a particular person was on a poverty line rather than a wealth line. They'd use a little different language because economists have refined the language without penetrating more deeply into wisdom. But they use words like human capital, which is what you are worth in terms of your education and work experience. In any case, following this period, the Industrial Revolution took roots, and the center of wealth changed from commerce to industry. And so the new powerful class were not the entrenched landed aristocracy, but the people who owned the factories. And they got wealthy, obviously, by paying labor less than they got for themselves. By the last quarter of the 19th century, a new monopoly class had developed, not the monopoly class of commerce in the early period, but an industrial monopoly class. And so the liberals, always concerned with the plight of the ordinary person, after all, liberals are good people and always have been, the liberals began to be worried by this agglomeration of power and wealth in the hands of what were thought to be shady industrialists. And so they began to shift to a pro-government intervention in order to have greater egalitarianism, greater social efficiency, and perhaps less instability. And so the first main line then is that the liberals of Smith's period became the conservatives of the later period. But those liberals that were true to the spirit of liberalism changed their policy from being laissez-faire to being in favor of government intervention. The conservatives, on the other hand, developed in an opposite direction, because the conservatives who originally were in favor of government, because they ran the government, they controlled the government, they began to see that, especially in England, that they no longer needed the state. They, in fact, would have less trouble about regulations if state power was reduced. So you have the conservatives going from strong government intervention to less government intervention, and liberals going from no government intervention to very much of a concern with reducing inequality, reducing privilege. To give you a typical example of today so you can associate, you've all heard of John Kenneth Galbraith. He's kind of the quintessential liberal, favors government intervention. Well, he favors a welfare state. It was the New Deal that was the personification of liberalism, because they favored things like Social Security, government support for unemployment, whereas the true market person would deal with something like the right to a job, saying that workers have the right to search for a job, and that's all, which, of course, is a very dubious right. But that's as far as they would go. In fact, they would not even favor a minimum wage, because they would say that that interferes with the efficiency created by a market system. I'll get to the particular kind of conservative we have now, because I want to postulate a new idea that the administration since Reagan, that is Reagan and Bush primarily, with Clinton thrown in, represent a new stage of capitalism, at least a new stage in terms of the relationship between the state and capitalists. But remember, in orthodox conservative theory, they favor a laissez-faire state where the market is what needs to operate in as many ways as possible, both in the labor market and the capital market and even international trade and international capital movements. All right. Now, with that in mind, let's get back to real parties in America and where they fit in, because I think some of the ideas of conservatism and liberalism will make more sense. So, in other words, I'm mentioning Smith to show the start, and then the Industrial Revolution, and that the immediate impact was, in terms of ideology, was to more and more economists worshiping at the altar of the free market. In fact, until the 1930s, there was one major textbook in the West that went through about 8 editions, and it was based on the free market. It left out all sorts of things that entered the textbooks following the Great Depression. But through the 1920s, the basic idea among economists was that the role of the economist was to show how resources are allocated, how people make choices, how they go into the market with limited amounts of income and confronted by prices that they have no control over, and they try to maximize their well-being. The word the economist used was their utility. You might ask, well, what about business cycles? Assumed away. They assumed in all their models that full employment was the norm of capitalist society and that any unemployment was either temporary or, get this, it was due the people's choices. In other words, a person that was unemployed was someone who had a high leisure preference. In other words, that was the choice you were making. Either working, in which case you would get an income, or leisure, in which you were saying, well, my preference is simply not to work. That gives me psychic income. And in the modern era, people in this school have dealt with all sorts of things like racism and sexism. Why are women's wages, for example, lower than men? Well, it's because they choose to be in the labor force intermittently, and therefore they don't accumulate the experience that men have. And therefore, their low wages is not due to the market, it's not due to capitalism, it's due to personal preferences. And racism, and this is by somebody that got the Nobel Award, is incompatible with capitalism, because if a capitalist indulges what he calls a taste for discrimination, in other words, he's a boss, he looks out at the labor force in his plant and he likes a sea of white. Anything other than that gives him the jumbies. And therefore, as long as there are some black workers who are more productive than some white workers, and the capitalist chooses white workers, then his costs will be higher than the non-discriminatory capitalist, and therefore the free market grinds out discrimination. Now, of course, if you ask, so how come even after a few hundred years of this, there's still these vast discrepancies, that isn't something they prefer to deal with. That's kind of history, should be discussed and studied by historians. And so it's with the 1930s that there was a significant change. And I mention this because in many ways it produced the father of modern liberalism. And that is a man, the most influential economist of the 20th century, a man by the name of Keynes, wrote a book in which he tried to refute some of the logic of these classical economists, but without rocking the boat in a fundamental way. And so he said, well, the norm of capitalism without the government would be to bump along at various levels of unemployment. But if you have an interventionist government, it can smooth out the cycle. If, for example, we're in a recession, the government needs to come in and spend more increase the money supply and lower the interest rates so that people will go out in the market and buy. So an economy that's at less than full employment can be pushed up by intelligent, selective government intervention within a capitalist society. Okay? In other words, the problem is not the structure of capitalism. The problem is government policy, and that a laissez-faire policy produces wide swings in the business cycle. So you counter that and you make the system operate more effectively. The marriage of that and the New Deal led to the development of a welfare state. Now, the welfare state, as it was originally described by a man named Beveridge in post-war II England, was cradle to the grave security. And it was the idea that it was sort of what I would call soft socialism, that capitalism as a cyclic system needed active aid by the government in order to make the system more stable and less inequitable. The combination of the two. Stabilize the system and make it operate more effectively in both human and economic terms. Now, there is no doubt that, let's say, a change from a conservative administration to a liberal administration would certainly improve the quality of life. it's nicer to have subsidized housing than to be homeless in the streets. It's nicer to get an allowance when you're unemployed. It's nicer to get workman's compensation. All sorts of things, by the way, that did not exist prior to the New Deal. Also, it's probably better psychically, at least for the poor, to have taxes that are more progressive than less progressive. And in other words, taxes that have a lower rate on the poor than on the rich. The exact inverse of what's happening now, you know. We'll get to that. And so liberalism, in human terms, is certainly a turn for the better in terms of the vast majority of the people. One of the interesting questions is, so how come it's changing? How come under a Democratic administration, Clinton's, you had the first dramatic step towards a change in the welfare system? He said, welfare will never be what it was, that we have to change. And in other areas of policymaking, you know that the liberals, well, not Siamese twins of the conservatives, have certainly moved in that direction. It was a small minority of liberals, liberal Democrats, that took a different position than the president on the war. A very modest number. Oh, they all wanted to get their candidate in, but it was more along the line, we can do it more effectively. Well, that's the name of politics. You know, obviously, there's a big cookie jar, and it's easier to dip your fingers in it if you're in the party in power than if you're in the party out of power. Although there are some people who are really neutral between Democrats and Republicans and want their neutral hand in the cookie jar just for the purposes of getting rich. That's standard capitalist operating procedure. And in fact, the Russians, planners, imitated that, although not as effectively. One of the questions then is, was there a change in the structure of the system that tended to move the Democrats closer to the center and the Republicans even further to the right? And I claim that there is. And my explanation is that starting probably in the 70s, but certainly by the 80s, and absolutely for sure in the 90s, globalization became the norm. One of the things that triggered it, in my opinion, in America, is that America by the 80s was losing out relative to Japan and Germany. They had a newer, more efficient plant than we did. Well, rather than scrap the whole thing, nobody does that, they increased pressure against their working class. And that is, they drove wages down. They broke up many unions. And the effect of that was that they could then compete more effectively with Germany and Japan because they sweated more out of their workers. A way that they could do this to increase that pressure was to ship production out of the country. Now, they didn't have a monopoly on doing that. Europe and even Japan started to do that. The great advantage of that was that you could get around the higher wage structure in America by shifting, outsourcing production from America to these other countries. How's that connected with politics? It goes like this, that the pressure against the workers and the workers' unions did, in fact, drive wages down. The combination of the government assisting big business in doing this and the normal pressures of international capitalist competition led to what one economist called a race to the bottom. And by that term, we mean that if I in country X have a lower wage structure than you in country Y, somebody is going to try to compete with me to get me to lower. And so that country Z comes in and they get a temporary advantage because their wages are lower than X and Y. And so countries get a temporary advantage by attracting capital from the advanced countries, like let's say under NAFTA. You know, there was a certain amount of capital that went into the plants on the frontier with Texas. And Mexico got a certain increase in production, a certain increase in jobs, at wages slightly above what they had before, under horrific working conditions and mostly involving women labor. But it didn't last forever because countries like Bangladesh or Liberia or other countries on the edge of survival began to offer their wage. And so you have a kind of moving plant, capital moving out. Well, you see, the theory of capitalism of the market people is, well, that's good. If I represent America and you're the third world, I have a lot of capital and you have a small amount of capital. And therefore, I can get only a low return here and a higher return there. And lo and behold, in their model, over the long run, however defined, we'll both benefit. You'll get my capital and therefore grow. But it doesn't always work that way. Because if my advantage, or to be consistent, your advantage, a country like Guatemala might be in bananas, and mine might be in high-class engines. And so, according to their model, countries should specialize in the production of things that they have the greatest advantage. Bananas for you and engines for me. In theory, if you get capital from my country, you can start your own factories. But that's not what is encouraged by the big countries, powerful countries that run the world. They want to maintain their hegemony. And so it is the, in my opinion, the globalization of the world that produced more and more pressure on the capitalists to drive wages low. Economists are always able to come up with theories to please the people that pay them. So what is then developed by economists are ways of justifying this new international inequality. And I'm sure that you know that we have reached the peak level of inequality both at home, that is within America, and between the developed and undeveloped countries. A small percentage of the population, about 1%, have the same wealth as the lower 45%. And it shows no signs of abatement. Whereas for the classical economists, government was a neutral force. Under this new stage of capitalism, roughly dating from 1980, the web of history is a very tangled one and it's hard to pick out specific dates unless you're dealing with a war. And even then, the effects may not be felt immediately. In any case, the new stage of capitalism is one in which the government becomes a truly active force, but not for welfare for the masses, but welfare for a very specific group. And that is the role of government more and more under the current administration has been to open up areas of very profitable investment. One doesn't have to be a great physicist to know that when the U.S. went in to Iraq, and tomorrow there'll be other countries, that a main beneficiary or main group of beneficiaries were connected with the government. It's what you, this new stage, for want of a better term, you could call it crony capitalism, or a mixture of crony capitalism and casino capitalism, you know, gambling, but as much as possible with other people's money. You have the government then as an active intervener in the economic process in which it attempts to aid at least a certain part of the capitalist class. So there's still competition, but it's very clear that the government has an enormous impact in opening up areas for investment. Then there's another way it works, because the government is connected with taxes and spending. This is an idea that went back to Keynes, this writer from the 1930s, but it's now being used in a brilliant way by the conservatives, and that is they know that we're deeply in debt. After all, being the world's policeman is a kind of expensive thing. And so what is needed to be done if you want to be favorably inclined to your friends is to reduce the spending for the poor and to lower the taxes for the rich. What you then have is a system which operates to maximize the income of the wealthy while keeping that of the poor at a stable or falling level, putting pressure on ordinary people, for example, to take care of their own medical needs. And so the numbers of people without medical care is now up to about 45 million. One way we deal with housing is to have building jails as a growth industry. It's our way. I don't quite believe this, but it's one of the ways we deal with the housing shortage. And that specific and that has a racial aspect, because as you know, blacks and Hispanics are a highly disproportionate number of the people in jail, and even higher number of those on death row. It may well be that the law is starting to act more ferociously towards the poor, because the economic policies are such that the burden is borne more and more by the poor. Well, you can only do that up to a certain level, unless you believe in some kind of genetic theory of theft or violence. By the way, you have to recognize that this gross increase in inequality is somehow connected with violence, which can take numerous forms, and many negative features of society for the masses of people. So what does this add up to? Well, as I see it, an economy that is in crisis is probably, from the point of view of the ruling class, better advanced by the conservatives. I'll get back to that sentence in a moment. Whereas an expanding economy is much more conducive to liberal administrations. The reason is that it's easier to get elected if you promise a little to this group, a little to that group, and deliver some of it. Well, you can do that in a period in which the overall economy is expanding. For example, the heyday of liberalism was the post-war II period, because we were the only country to emerge richer than when we entered. the war. And so in this period, even the blacks did better. The gap between blacks and whites and women and men narrowed. Not completely, but improvement. And people vote very often on improvement, whether things are getting better or getting worse. But the day of reckoning was the 70s, middle 70s, where it became clear that an advanced capitalist economy could not be kept stable by these Keynesian remedies, because we had what was called stagflation, that is, a combination of inflation and unemployment. In Keynes's way of looking at the world, and economists were all Keynesians for a while, it was impossible to have those two things. First of all, Keynes didn't spend much attention on prices. He was concerned with inflation and unemployment. What developed, I think, as a result of the growing monopolization of the economy, was that there was a built-in tendency to inflation, because monopolies always want to charge the most they can get away with, and they're in a better position to do it than a small firm. A small firm, if they're not selling a good, they'll have a bargain basement sale, lower the prices, and hope that they can do better. Whereas in, let's say, the automobile sector, when they weren't selling very well, they kept prices high and simply laid off the workers, because their break-even point was at less than 40% of production. So what you do when you have monopoly power is that it has an effect on the macro economy, which makes it much less flexible. In fact, it makes it relatively inflexible. And so the globalization occurred at the period where monopolies had already made the economy inflexible. And it was with globalization that each country had a very strong incentive to twist the rope on the working class, because if they could drive their wages down, they could get a temporary advantage. That is the role served by the new conservative. The new conservative is not one that's theoretically in favor of hands off by government. That's just a few right-wing intellectuals like Ayn Rand. You've probably heard of her. You know, she really believed in laissez-faire. And in fact, unlike all the rest of the conservatives, she's even an atheist, whereas all the other conservatives recognize that religion can be useful economically. You know, get people off on that, especially you pit them against another religion. It's as useful as sexism and racism. But except for a few intellectuals, in fact, I heard one on the radio the other day, she doesn't count. What does count is the Bush type of conservative that wants to use government to redistribute income, to put the workers in their place. And he has succeeded to a very significant extent. And oddly enough, even among some blacks, there are a number of blacks, both on a political level and economists, trained economists, who are really Milton Friedmanites with a different color skin. There's a man that you all should read if you want to find out about this type of thinking, named Tom Sowell, S-O-W-E-L-L. And in fact, he's at a very prominent conservative think tank called the Hoover Institute in California. He's against affirmative action. He's against minimum wages, against all sorts of handouts. His line of reasoning is that it distorts the functioning of the free market. In fact, we have a Supreme Court justice that fits in to that way of thinking, which is why progressive legislation in the past may very well be under greater attack. What we then have is a conservative group that is tending to go beyond the free market to a new form of authoritarianism. And that is where we are in a dangerous state. Now, then the question is, well, doesn't that make it all the more useful to vote for the lesser of evils? After all, the Democrats aren't yet authoritarian. In fact, some of them are nice people. Some of them are even in favor of these old New Deal ventures. My point about that is that capitalism is in a structural crisis. The structural crisis is not going to be alleviated by voting for the best of the capitalist parties. There are certain prerogatives that capitalism needs in order to survive. The most liberal democratic administration is not going to dramatically interfere with the distribution of income. Why? Because inequality is functionally necessary for capitalism to survive. Can you conceive of capitalism where the capitalist gets the same return as the workers? That's impossible. The capitalist would say, why should I produce? And so this doesn't mean that there is a so-called optimum distribution of income. That's just a theoretical concept, because you have to ask, optimum with respect to what? What we know is that all systems want to maintain basic hegemony, basic power. Under pressure, they will all give up something. And maybe the Democrats are a little more sensitive to where they have to bend. But the system at its very best is not only a system of inequality, but social inefficiency, alienation, a lack of control over output. When you, a worker, enter a factory or an office, you essentially give up the right to original thinking. Now, you can do your job better or worse. That is true. You may make a little more or a little less, although whether you make a little more or a little less isn't always a function of efficiency. It may be a function of getting it on with the boss. What we do know is that the system has certain basic prerogatives, and those prerogatives are untouched by whether Mr. Tweedledee or Mrs. Tweedledee or Mr. or Mrs. Tweedledum gets elected. A choice between the lesser of two evils is really what I would call a choice between who will misrepresent you more or misrepresent you less. But the misrepresentation is in the basic structure, because the basic structure is one of classes. It's the class factor that is the dominant one, which leads to this interesting question. What about democracy? Is there a class concept that affects democracy? Let's say that we have, I'll go back to race for this reason. Suppose that every black got the same salary as every white, and every woman, same salary as every man. How do we describe that? I would say it means that you have changed from a situation of getting different amounts to getting similar amounts, but your class situation is the same. In other words, the change is one of moving from unequal exploitation to equal exploitation. Now, I don't mean to say that that's not improvement. Certainly, if a black got the salary of a white and a woman of a man, for them, it is improvement. But it doesn't affect the basic class relationship in society. Democracy is, in a political sense, a very narrow concept, and that is, it means the right to express yourself freely, groups like this, to meet, hopefully without trouble, the right to attend a church of your desire, the right to the Bill of Rights. But it is not what I would call economic democracy, because economic democracy is that those that produce the wealth have the right to determine how it's to be used, determine what to produce and how to distribute it. Now, it doesn't mean that it'll automatically be totally equally distributed, but that is a choice made by those who produce the wealth. Now, then you might say, well, capitalists also produce the wealth. Well, what I would say to that is that given capitalism, they do make decisions. But I dare say that if capitalists vanished as a class, that the group that was left would make a similar type of decision, but they would change some of the results. They might have a group of workers meeting to make decisions about more of this or less of that, or whether wages this term should go up or down. So, in other words, what I'm saying is capitalism is a class system. The power is wielded by a capitalist class against the other classes in society. The role of the state is, by and large, to act as a helper of the ruling class. It doesn't mean that everyone in the government has no sympathy for labor. But that's not the... If they worshipped really avidly at that altar, they would be out. You can only have a certain amount of sentimentality that's allowable. So I'm saying that there is a fundamental cleavage between democracy and capitalism, which is the direct opposite of what is being presented. Because what is being presented, in fact, the first time it was presented in its pristine beauty was a book called The Road to Serfdom, where a man named Hayek stated that the road to government, no less socialism, was the road to serfdom, that the only democratic society was a capitalist society, because it is the only society that allows perfect freedom of everybody to determine what they will do. I remember my teacher once illustrating that by saying, look, here we got a working day of 8 hours, and the boss comes to you and says, would you like to work the ninth hour? And what you do is to weigh the utility of spending the income that you get from that ninth hour against the disutility of work of that ninth hour. That's typical orthodox thinking. No one's raising the question of power. What would happen to a worker? The boss comes and says, I want you to work the ninth hour. You say, that's not the way I add it up. That probably would be the last addition that you would be making. Because usually the market has enough unemployment that you do not have the same rights as the capitalist. You may have the right to vote every fourth year for candidates that are remarkably similar, but the economy, the means of communication, are owned by and large by a class of people that make the decisions that affect our lives. You have some margin of maneuverability, that is, with education, with training, with a success-oriented family, you are likely to be better off, and white, you're likely to be better off than a person with the reverse of that. There is a margin of maneuverability. And in fact, I can envisage a post-capitalist society that might make use of some of these tools of economic analysis. Because with a planned society, we can then say, this will be the distribution of income. In other words, it's not simply the outcome of the market. We determine that politically, more or less. And then you use the free market to let people with an egalitarian distribution of income spend their salaries for services and goods that they want. And in fact, if they don't like the goods, let them exchange it for someone else. And you can even have small individuals having their own stores if they want, because technically they are neither workers nor capitalists. You see, capitalism is a social relationship. It's a relationship between a property-owning class and a working class. Capital is not just a good used to turn out consumer goods. Capital is social power, economic power. It's only in a post-capitalist society that capital is under the control of those that produce the wealth in our system. Even the capitalists will have, for the first time, the ability to become fuller human beings. Because even though I'm against capitalists as a class, capitalists as individual human beings, I think, suffer from being on a treadmill. My father was a small capitalist. He went 20 years without a vacation, thinking if he missed one day, the printing shop would collapse. And when I said to him, you know, that you're probably earning per hour the same as a worker, to him that was a non sequitur. He says, but here I'm my own boss. So he's the, even capitalists as individuals are prisoners of a system in which there is a trickle down of some of the benefits. But the main beneficiaries are a modest number of people, and it is they who determine the quality of our lives. And I think, and we'll go into this in more detail next time, I think they should be relieved of that burden. So I think what this study of conservatism and liberalism indicates is that even though there's a modest amount of benefits to the masses of people by the more liberal regime, there is a good argument for voting for the conservatives, because if you have to vote for one of the two, because the conservative represents something. He is saying that this is the class structure. The capitalists are the class that counts. You workers are lucky that you're getting a trickle down. The liberals sow the seeds of an illusion. They sow the seeds of the illusion that things are dramatically different for the ordinary person if they vote for the lesser of evils. And it's really two lessers rather than the lesser of evils. I think that it's crucial to recognize that except for the very short term, that both parties are part of the problem rather than one of them being part of the solution. We are between, in my opinion, a capitalist age that is in the process of a long and, I think, terminal crisis, and a new age that is sort of trapped in the birth canal. And as at least the women among you know, that's not a permanent condition. It somehow has to either terminate or go to the logical end. And I think ultimately you have to make a choice. Are you in favor of a system that promotes inequality, instability, alienation, war, sexism, racism, or a cooperative system that will offer, for the first time in human history, the possibility of transcending all those things?
That was Mel Lehman, Professor Emeritus of Economics, SUNY Binghamton, speaking at a public lecture on Bainbridge Island in Washington. Thanks to Alt Buzz and Crow Moon Sound for that recording. Coming up next, a reading from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education.